Good morning. I'm Warren Hoag, IPI's Vice President for External Relations, and I'm very happy to be host and co-sponsor with so many distinguished organizations of this meeting on sovereignty, democracy, human rights, dialogues on perpetual peace. This is a very unusual undertaking for us. We're holding an event based on an essay written more than 200 years ago at a moment when a number of us here at IPI have just returned from our inaugural Sirbanias Forum in Abu Dhabi, a joint effort between IPI and the United Arab Emirates that produced over a three-day retreat some very stark and vivid statements and views from foreign ministers and international experts on intensely current tensions in the Middle East. A quick rundown of our schedule of meetings and policy forum and roundtables shows that the normal subjects here are things like conflict in the Middle East, prospects for trouble in the coming referendum in Sudan, refugees, internally displaced persons, counterterrorism, weapons of mass destruction, the responsibility to protect, conflict prevention, sexual violence in the Congo. You get the picture. So it always provided a relaxing moment for me in recent months as I read down our list of upcoming events, and my eye would fall upon today's theme, dialogues on perpetual peace. And that is my opening message to you, which is we hope you will relax and take advantage of IPI's reputation as being a place where you can speak informally, freely, and frankly. Now, this is on the record. There are photographers here, and we're recording it so we can put a transcript on our website. But we're doing that pretty much for internal reasons, and also to have a record of today's exchanges, a record for scholarly purposes, if you will, and also a way for those of you who care to revisit today's conversations in the future. We hope that you will all participate. The format is a series of expert presentations, but this is in no way meant to be an auditorium-style event where speakers are on stage making prepared statements while the audience sits quietly around the table. The presentations are merely there to start the conversation going, and we want to blur the lines between speaker and participant. Now, to go back to my opening comments on the contrast between this event and our normal lineup, of course, part of our purpose today is to explore how the insights in Kant's essay might shed light on our understanding of contemporary issues of international law. And to start that conversation off and to find out how this idea, this text, became a project in the first place, let me turn this over to Aaron Levy, the Executive Director and Chief Curator of the Slout Foundation and a member of the faculty at Pennsylvania University. Aaron?
Thank you. It's a particular honor and a pleasure to be with all of you today. This project began at a small table roughly 1 year ago, and we were reading Immanuel Kant's text. And in the Perpetual Peace essay, what one finds is a secret article. And in that secret article is proposed a conversation across the disciplines, a conversation between the statesman and the philosopher. And so we've constructed a series of projects, of which today's workshop is the capstone event, around that secret clause, trying to propose again the idea of a conversation about peace at a moment when the very idea is received with particular suspicion in the academic and the cultural communities from which I am situated and based. As I said, today's event is the capstone. It is not the only initiative that's part of the Perpetual Peace Project, but it's one that we've worked for some time towards. I wanted to share with you some of the other activities that we've organized over the last few months. I've just returned from Lahore, Pakistan, where we've been working with students throughout Lahore, throughout the universities there, encouraging them to define peace in a variety of ways. We'll be conducting these workshops in Beijing, in Hong Kong, and elsewhere in Asia in the coming weeks. A feature film has been undertaken featuring a variety of statesmen and philosophers in conversation. Many of them are here today, Richard Sennett as an example. An exhibition is currently on display at the New Museum downtown, and we encourage you to visit it. It will be on display through January. And there are a variety of events each week featuring statesmen and philosophers in conversation. And there's a variety of other initiatives, and you can learn more about those on the project's website at perpetualpeaceproject.org. My final remark will be a brief one. This is also unusual in that it's a collaboration. particularly unusual for a cultural organization such as mine, the Slot Foundation, to engage in. And it couldn't have happened without every partner at the table. They're all listed in the material that you have in your folder. The European Union National Institutes of Culture has been a key partner from its very inception. The International Peace Institute, of course. Syracuse University Humanities Center, and as well the United Nations University. So I want to recognize the collaborative spirit that made today's event possible. And I'm simply going to turn it over to Orya Roman Patapivietchi, President of the EU Institutes for Cultural Global Network, UNIC, and President of the Romanian Cultural Institute Network. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here and to represent an unusual partner for you philosophers and theorists, which is the European Union National Institutes for Culture, which is a global network of national institutes belonging to EU structure and acting in EU and outside Europe, actually all over the world. It comprises a gathering of national institutes for culture, very different in shape, in tradition, and in history. For instance, the Romanian Culture Institute, which I represent, is a recent institute, and we action together with institutes with great tradition like British Council, like Goethe Institute, like Institut Français, and others. And we form a team around the common good, which is to promote not only national cultures, but also a spirit which is now mating up and mating out of our ideas of common good. And the fact that you philosophers and theorists, political theorists, are organizing with us, European Union National Institutes for Culture, such a distinguished workshop, is for us, National Institutes for Culture, a great opportunity to engage in something which we often forgot, which is to reflect about the fundamentals. We are very focused on present, on contemporary, and we tend to forget that the fundamentals of our very present being and the institutions and way of thinking and way of devising common good have deep root. And one of the deep root is, of course, the thinking of Immanuel Kant. What in some place in this Zum Ewigen Frieden, Kant is saying that perhaps it is not desirable that kings became philosophers or the philosophers became kings, but what is of highest desirability is that kings do hear what the philosophers are saying. In that sense, I think it's very important for a National Institute for Culture to hear what philosophers and theorists are saying about the fundamentals of our being and of our way of devising common good. And a last remark. I don't know the person who had this brilliant idea to present us the book of Kant, Zum Ewigen Frieden, in that shape. It's an excellent example, a living example of this kind of palimpsest, which fundamental text is presenting to our grasp now. But there is another thing which is very important, the fact that you have to work out this book in order to have it. It's an open book, but it's a book which you ought to work out in order to get access to the text. And this is very important. I congratulate you, and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
It's now my pleasure to introduce, very briefly, our keynote speaker. He is Norbert Darabos, the Minister of Defense and Sports of the Government of Austria. His biography, like that of all our speakers today, his full biography, is printed in your program. IPI is 40 years old this year. And from our beginnings in 1970, we have always had a special relationship with Austria. Each of our 40 years, we have held a seminar in Vienna called the Vienna Seminar. And we just months ago opened a European office of IPI and placed it where? In Vienna. So, Mr. Darabos, you were very welcome. You should feel at home here at IPI.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me and an honor for me to be here in New York, and that it is possible for me to say some words as keynotes here to you. I would like to begin by thanking the organizers of this conference for giving me the opportunity to discuss topics that are well suited to combine theoretical principles with current political questions and challenges. As Minister of Defense and of a country that has been involved in and committed to UN peacekeeping missions for over 50 years and has sent 80,000 personnel abroad, I will focus on political questions and on the future challenges of requirements of international security policy. Politics always has to be based on values. Values are closely related to philosophy, so let me start by talking about the fundamentals of peace. What is security? Security exists if there is either no threat or there are sufficient capacities to defend against any threat. It can be achieved by either increasing the capacities or by reducing the threats. Hence, traditional Cold War concepts of security emphasized lowering the probability of defeat by increasing military power. Today, threat reduction rather than capacity enhancement meets the requirements of the post-Cold War security environment. Since deterrence is no longer the way to create security, one has to form comprehensive concept of security which ranges from military to humanitarian actions. Today, dealing with current threats and challenges to security more and more often means dealing with the security of people and less with the security of states. The philosophical discourse features two opposing ideas. In the world of hopes, states are enemies. The world is anarchic without any superior regulating authority. States build up capacities. Security means waging wars or, if at all successful, creating a balance of power. By contrast, In the world of Kant, states are partners. Rather than building up military capacities, states solve or prevent threats through crisis management. The foundation of perpetual peace is not a balance of power that generates stability, but a federation of states with multilateral international order. In the 21st century, the real danger is no longer the anarchy of the world of hopes and threats emerging from strong states. On the contrary, it is predominantly the weak state, the failed or failing state, and the lack of legitimate governance in such states that constitute a threat. Therefore, security policy in or times is about building functioning sovereign states. Today's threats are no longer primarily military in nature, caused by strong states with large and strong armed forces. Today's threats are international crime, terrorism, and cybersecurity, the risk of sabotage on infrastructure, illegal immigration, environmental damage, shortcomings with respect to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. The European security strategy, so I come to Europe, the European security strategy asserts a need and a role for the European Union in global security. The document defines proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, uncontrolled immigration, climate change, poverty, and first and foremost failed states as the principal new challenges. To meet these challenges, the European security strategy calls for combined civil-military actions. Regarding the military aspect, it calls for member nations to share military resources. It would take another conference to talk about the shortfalls resulting from 27 different military systems and structures in the European Union. Austria, my home country, Austria supports a more active international role of the European Union. Together with our European partners, we stand for effective multilateralism, the rule of law, and human rights. In this context, the further deepening of European Union and UN relations is very important. Based on the lessons we, Austria, and some other countries in Europe learned in the recent Chad operation, I support a closer cooperation with regard to doctrinal developments, better liaison arrangements, and harmonization of training concepts. Let me come back to Kant. The idea of Kant is based on democratic peace with the stable sovereign state at its heart. Stable sovereign state require as a minimum the creation of a stable society with good governance and a working administration. As Max Weber has pointed out, the goal should be the functioning state with the rule of law, civil administration, democracy, and the legitimate monopoly of the use of force. In the process of peace building, and according to our view of human beings, human security and human rights play a crucial role today. In the 90s, it became evident that traditional peacekeeping with the consent of the parties to the conflict is not enough. We can therefore observe a serious discussion of the future of peacekeeping within the United Nations. Austria was and will be committed to and involved in the further development of UN peacekeeping. I'm deeply convinced that modern peacekeeping operations require both military and civilian means. There is an urgent need for the combined use of these two means, which were traditionally strictly separated. The incumbent Security Generalist report of peace building in the immediate aftermath of conflicts rightly points out that despite important progress made by the United Nations and its partners, the main challenges remain. I will come to these efforts to enhance effective leadership both at UN headquarters and in the field, as well as those aimed at approved planning and strategy development. Enhanced coordination must also take place outside the UN system in order to avoid duplication and to ensure efficiency to peace-building efforts. We appreciate efforts to intensify cooperation with regional and sub-regional organizations such as the European Union and the African Union, as well as with the international financial institutions. It is essential to make maximum use of partners with a comparative advantage on the ground. Austria has stressed the importance of national ownership in peace building. In order to promote national leadership, all peace building efforts need to draw upon existing national capacities to the greatest extent possible. We therefore welcome recent efforts to assess existing capacities as a basis for the development of international expertise. The ongoing review of civilian capacities will contribute to ensuring that civilian expertise for peacebuilding is deployed in timely manner, and that's specialized skills to address women's and children's needs in conflict situations are included. This is a point the Security Council has discussed during the past years. Restoring the rule of law and ensuring respect for human rights, providing for effective disarmament, demobilization and reintegration of former combatants, security sector reform and the return and reintegration of refugees and IDPs must be key priorities in the immediate aftermath of a conflict. In my view, peacekeeping operations can be described as human security operations. In a human security operation, the job of the military is to protect and preserve human beings rather than fight an enemy. Within this context, Security Council Resolution 1894 concerning the protection of civilians is a cornerstone in the development of modern peacekeeping. I would like to add that this resolution was passed when Austria was the presidency. Closely related to the concept of human security and the concept of responsibility to protect, states have to protect their citizens against genocide, massive human rights violations, poverty, and in the long run from the consequences of climate change. The primary responsibility lies with the state itself. If the state is unwilling or unable to deal with these issues, it cedes its responsibility to the international community and international organizations. Such a security strategy emphasizes threat reduction. It regards peacekeeping not as post-conflict battlefield policing, but as an endeavor to create peace by protecting people. When talking about the future of peacekeeping, we should keep in mind that new challenges raise new questions with regard to state sovereignty. Beginning with the Kosovo conflict in 1999, the humanitarian intervention which ended the conflict, a substantial paradigm shift in international public law occurred. Responsibility to protect is the consequence of this development, which wouldn't have been possible without Kant's concept of perpetual peace. The basis of this development was laid already at the beginning of the 20th century by the Austrian School of International Law, and here mainly by Hans Kelsen, who was the architect of the Austrian Constitution. This contradicted the German school around Carl Schmitt, which principally denied any right of interference in national affairs. As you can see, the debate on sovereignty and its boundaries is not so new as it may appear. If force is used or has to be used, the first and foremost question has to be, who decides on the use of force? The legal authority to decide this question cannot be a single state or a regional association. In the framework of a global collective security system, first and foremost, The Security Council of the United Nations will have to be the authorizing agent. A mandate of the General Assembly or the OSCE may be sufficient only if there are cases of genocide or a fundamental matter of conscience. In case of genocide, massive human rights violations, the international norm of collective security should have precedence over state sovereignty. Ladies and gentlemen, what consequences for the armed forces have to be drawn from the current discussion of the future of peacekeeping? Less and less do military operations mean war fighting, but rather the organization and training aimed at projecting low intensity power, keeping the peace and assisting in the reconstruction of societies after wars and violent conflicts, and last but not least, providing humanitarian support in disaster relief. The primary task of the armed forces is no longer to defeat an enemy, but to protect people. The military should give up its unwillingness to contribute troops for peacekeeping and nation or state building. For post-conflict reconstruction, peacekeeping, state building, and low intensity capabilities, special equipped and trained armed and police forces are necessary. Traditional peacekeeping has to face these new challenges and new developments. We have to integrate the considerations into the training of our civilian and military personnel when we prepare them for new operations. Therefore, Austria will support every initiative to enhance military pre-deployment training with regard to the United Security Council Resolution 1325 on gender issues and 1894 on the protection of civilians. The Austrian Armed Forces are ready to participate fully in this discussion and development since we can look back on 50 years of participation in peacekeeping, as I mentioned it, where we have always had to find answers to changing circumstances and challenges. These new conditions and challenges mean that an entirely new concept of security has emerged. This is no longer a world in which the destruction of enemies is the primary goal, as in previous centuries and in the concept of Hobbes, where states always have to be prepared to defeat their enemies. Today, it's more about the protection of people and saving lives. It is about human security that puts the individual at the center of security and safety. It is also about building societies and not destroying them. And this concept comes much closer to Kant and perpetual peace, or at least to a temporary, sustainable peace. Thank you very much for listening.
Our next speaker, Michael Doyle, is really one of us. He is now the Harold Brown Professor of International Affairs, Law, and Political Science at Columbia University. Michael is on our board of directors, and he was vice president and senior fellow of this organization when it was known as the International Peace Academy, and when its business was training peacekeepers. He is also a star of a movie we made this year about the 40-year history of IPI, as recounted by IPI's leaders, past and present. So if you don't get enough of Michael Doyle today, he is still there, alive and talking, at www.ipinst.org. Thank you very much, Warren. It's a real source of comfort to me to know that I live on in video at the IPI. This has been an institution very dear to my heart, and I want to join you in welcoming everybody here, speaking as a member of the board. I very much appreciated the remarks of Minister Darabas on Kant as a father of human security. I think that gets many of the things that are most important in his philosophy correct. What I'd like to do in the few minutes that I have is go back to the 1790s and talk a little bit about the context in which Kant was writing, the problems that he thought he was saving, and I plan to do so very briefly. He was inspired by the French Revolution, the early, we should note, French Revolution. The Constitution of 1791 of France, the one that the early reformers put together, was to him an ideal document. It's worth reading today. It's a magnificent document. He thought that the French Revolution, which inspired him, would inspire others to join together in a league for peace. Now, the ironies of that don't need to be underlined. Within a short period after that, the Jacobins had taken over, and these hopes had been reduced to the terror. Europe was at war, one of the bloodiest wars, and it would last for another 20 years. So he died very pessimistic. He stopped teaching months after he published this document, and he went into retirement. He still wrote a few other things, but he was clearly deeply pessimistic, and some of his last writings reflect that. But let's go back to the 1790s, his period, the period of high optimism that we can see, his highest period of optimism in this particular document. I want to address two problems that I think he thought he was addressing. All of those qualifications are real. We don't have a diary that could help us guide us through all of that. And the two problems were war and democracy. Yes, democracy. And then I want to briefly again describe the what you have in the document in front of you, Perpetual Peace, which are his solutions to those two problems, the problem of war and the problem of democracy. What is the problem of war? Well, he's an 18th century figure. And so remember, for the first half of this century, there's the War of the Spanish Secession, the War of the Austrian Secession, a whole series of violent conflicts. There's the Seven Years' War, beginning in 1756. That is the First World War. That is a war that was fought on multiple continents. So a very bloody century he faced. Then in the second half of the century, fewer big international wars, other than the internationalization of the unilateral secession of the United States from the British Empire, which was costly, but an extensive state of war. That is a condition of insecurity and arms races, a naval arms race between the UK and France, and a military land-based arms race between Austria, Prussia, Russia, and France. So both war and the state of war, that is, the arms races, the building, the tension, for him were huge problems. They needed to be addressed. They were painful in his time with the great consequences that you see him talk about in Perpetual Peace. The second context that he was facing was the problem of democracy. That is, the classical heritage was that democracy was dangerous. From Thucydides, we learned that democracies are faction-prone. They are prone to log-rolling, adventurous policies, such as the log-rolling that produced the decision of the Athenian assembly to invade Sicily, which then destroyed Athenian democracy. So democracies are deeply dangerous. There are two classical solutions to it. One, you keep them very small, isolated, poor, so that they're simple, and then deliberation can help introduce a degree of rational decision-making. Or alternatively, you create the mixed state. You mix together a monarchy, an aristocracy, and some democracy, and they tend to balance each other and produce a more stable, larger state. Those were the two classical solutions. But in the 18th century, an overwhelming document, a set of documents, that is a set of writings by Rousseau, totally destroyed the idea of the legitimacy of aristocratic and monarchic government for the liberals and Democrats on the end who believed in common human equality. The social contract overwhelmed Kant when he first read it, as did Emile. It revolutionized his thinking on social and political questions. He was persuaded that human dignity required civic equality, not monarchical rule, not aristocratic rule, and it discredited utterly, therefore, the mixed state. So Rousseau then, in the social contract, turns to the problem of how his social contract democracy can be safe. He says it's, and I quote, it's very small, will it not be subjugated? So we're back into these classical problems. And in the later parts of the work, Rousseau acknowledged the security advantages of a monarchy because it could be large, and the problems that only a republic, as a democratic republic, could be just. And then in a footnote in the social contract, he says, I will come back to this in part two of the social contract, where I will talk about confederations. That is, how you could join together democracies so that they could become secure in a dangerous world. Well, as we know, he never wrote part two. But Kant did read the social contract. And what he, I think, is trying to do is to come up with a solution of war and a solution of democracy, which can nonetheless reflect civic equality. That is, he needs to solve both those problems. Democracies are dangerous, and on the other hand, war is horrible. And yet only a government of civic equality is just and corresponding with human dignity and the respect that we owe to all human beings as ends. So that's his problem. Kant, by the way, wasn't aware of Madison's solution to this problem in Federalist No. 10, that is, diversity through faction. He wasn't aware of what Rousseau himself said about this problem. Rousseau gave up on the idea of a confederation. He thought it was just not possible. So he reverted back to isolationism, his essay on Corsica. You had to be just completely isolated from the world, then you might survive. So Rousseau left as a pessimist. But what did Kant try to solve? Well, let's say that he begins with an acknowledgement that Hobbes is right. That is, that international politics is a state of nature which is a state of war. And then I quote, states are like lawless savages, exist in a condition devoid of right. This condition is one of war. It's absolutely clear. He is simply tracking Hobbes. International law is no guarantee of justice or safety in these circumstances. Given this world, there is a right to make war when you're injured and legal proceedings don't satisfy your claim, or when you believe that you've been injured and legal proceedings don't satisfy your claim, or when you experience a threat to your national security when another state makes preparations for war, or when another state, making no threat whatsoever, has a large increase in its power, which is inherently threatening, given the fact that there's no source of international order, what we political scientists call the security dilemma. And these are all the rightful sources of war. Then, of course, there are plenty of wrongful sources. He knows that many states are aggressive, imperialistic, exploitative, etc. And other states, including the right-oriented states, have to live in that world. It's a pretty grim situation. So the ideal solution to all this would be to create a world state and create security. But that's impossible. It would be tyrannical in his view. The world is much too diverse to sustain a world state. So what does a well-meaning 18th century political philosopher do? Well, he comes up with the document that you have in front of you. One, first of all, if one is going to operate as a full and ethical human being, realize that one has responsibilities to all human beings across the world. You have to begin with this ethical commitment to understand that all human beings have to be treated as ends, that they have rights and interests that must be respected. If our own autonomy is going to have a real meaning, we must recognize that in all human beings. So to start with, you need to have a conception of moral duties. And this is where Kant then departs from Hobbes. He thinks this operates across borders. And what he does, therefore, he says, we need to start to create a situation of more trust. And that's what those preliminary articles are about in the first half of the document, this hypothetical treaty he suggests that states should sign. So ethical states should make sure that they sign genuine peace treaties that are transparent. They should never conquer other states or inherit them, establishing the norm of territorial integrity in addition to the open covenants norm. Standing armies should be gradually abolished. No national debt should be incurred for the purpose of going to war. You shouldn't engage in intervention in the political independence of other states, and you shouldn't commit war crimes. What's happening here is he's beginning to introduce some of the norms, the modern norms, of sovereign equality, that is, the norms of political independence, territorial integrity, international humanitarian law. And from the standpoint of political scientists, he's beginning to establish the basis for rational political action, that is, enhancing information so we don't have secret treaties, making sure that costs are internalized rather than externalized. So present generations have to pay for wars rather than future generations, making them less likely. And second of all, that the sunk cost of militaries be reduced so that the temptation to use them is reduced. And for all of these reasons, therefore, hoping to have a more rational arrangement. But noticeably, this is an ethical argument he's making. It's designed to create the basis for a more stable order, but it does not produce a reliable peace. Peace has to be constitutionalized, because in this world, even the world of the preliminary articles, wars are perfectly rational and perfectly justified if you have a reasonable basis to think you have been threatened. We're still in the state of war. So how do we get out of the state of war? And that's where the definitive articles you have in front of you come in. Those three hypothetical definitive articles, in his view, are what takes us out of the state of war and into a reliable peace. And so states have to sign all three of them. That is republicanism, the fatus pacificum, which is sort of like a collective security mechanism, and then a cosmopolitan recognition of the opportunity to engage in commerce and contact. The first of them is very important. It's his solution to the democracy problem. Direct democracies are tyrannical and faction-ridden and imprudent and dangerous, and therefore one needs to have a separation of powers, so there are checks and balances and deliberation, and no direct democracy, only democracy through representation. You send delegates to an assembly who are capable of deliberating. Nothing like the Athenian assembly where the thousands all showed up and shouted at each other. So this is the world of deliberative constitutional rule of law republics, very different from what they thought of in the 18th century as democracies. So there's deliberation to produce rational decision-making. And then at the same time, there are internal incentives to form peace. One of them, of course, is that citizens, because they have to pay the cost of war, they're the cannon fodder, et cetera, have a national hesitation, not pacifism, but a hesitation in going to war. This provides a rational restriction on wars other than ones that are necessary. And this is important because monarchs, he really does a number on monarchs, you remember from the Perpetual Peace, they are prone to make war as if it's simply a festival or a game because they don't bear the cost. So you need, in his view, a representative republic. Now, later in his writings, he qualifies that a little bit. He knows that not every single representative government is a republic. And he does a real number on Britain. He's kicking Montesquieu in the shins, by the way, who's an Anglophile. So Kant comes back and says, the British representative system is totally corrupt under George III and not a real republic. And on the other hand, you can imagine so pure, let's call him a probationary monarch, that this monarch is so virtuous that he exactly, or she, Maria Theresa, tracks the understanding of what a republic could do. So you don't want to absolutely exclude them, but they have to be perfect. But short of that, it has to be a republic, and that's condition number one. Condition number two, they have to publicly pledge to support each other, that is, not to aggress each other and to support each other. And then the hope is that France would have provided the first and others would then join in to form this league that would not be a government because that would be tyrannical. It's only a league to preserve peace, no other functions. And then I'm wrapping up here. The third element is then the cosmopolitan law, which is not free trade or a guarantee of it. It's simply a guarantee that a stranger showing up on your shores will not be treated with hostility. It opens up the possibility of engaging in commerce. There's not a right to engage in commerce or invest or settle. It's merely the right to show up and try to persuade the locals that an exchange is valuable. And he thinks, people being rational, these things will happen. There will be plenty of commerce. And the virtue of this is that in addition to recognizing these basic rights, which we now embed, by the way, in the 1951 Convention on Refugees, in addition to recognizing these rights, it provides the framework for a transnational society that'll let governments and peoples learn more about each other, enhance their respect and understanding for each other. So that's his argument. It's a league among republics because you can't have a league among at least the monarchs that he describes there, these war-prone ones, that wouldn't work. And so it's a league among republics that then separate themselves from what is otherwise a quasi-Hobbesian state of war.
And so in relations between these republics and non-republics, the republic should follow the preliminary articles, but he knows in the real world, unfortunately, they don't, and they should be condemned when they do not. Amongst themselves, the republic should establish the fata specificum. So let me wrap up there. I think that's what he was trying to do. And that's his solutions to the problems of democracy, which is also the Republican solution, small r, to the problem of peace, providing a framework for this League of Peace. It's not without its problems. Its virtues is that it helps us understand human security agenda, as the minister mentioned. It also helps us understand some of the foundations of the European Union, of the North American peace, of ANZUS, the alliance with New Zealand, Australia, also the alliance with Japan. This provides some philosophic foundations for it. But it's far from perfect. In my own opinion, I think it does a good job of motivating, let's call it, internal collective security, why republics don't go to peace with, don't go to war with each other. It doesn't quite motivate external collective security, why they will come to each other's rescue. I don't see that argument as strongly there. I may be missing it. And nor can we simply apply Kant. How many people here in the room whose full source of income is either rent from land or interest on capital, or they have a totally self-owned business, and that's your sole source of, that's your entire source of income? How many people fit that description? And you're male. And how many people fit that description? None. Well, none of us in this room could be full citizens. We'd be passive citizens. We couldn't be full citizens. We don't qualify with the proper degree because we're all salary workers of independence. So Kant, desirable as he is and profound and modern as he is, he condemns slavery. He condemns all sorts of other oppressions. He is not modern in our full sense of what we mean by democracy. It's a very different world, but it's nonetheless a world I think that we can learn a great deal from. And I'm very pleased that IPI has sponsored this dialogue on it today. Thank you.